Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of August. Monday at 9 is All Things Political. And we have as our guest this morning Professor Charles Lipson, who is a professor of political science specializing in international politics and international relations at the University of Chicago. He's also the author of a couple books recently published, Doing Honest Work in College and Succeeding as an International Student in the United States and Canada. He will be here to talk about a number of issues. We'll start with international news, certainly. Pakistani President Musharraf announcing today that he will resign. We will talk about that. We'll look at who's sending senators to Georgia and whether or not it may be an indication that Senator Joseph Biden is Obama's first pick because he's sending Biden to Georgia. And what about this whole issue? Does it benefit Senator McCain? Is he more on top of the Russia-Georgia situation than Obama? We'll look also at the meeting that took place, the scheduled, it wasn't really a debate, it was talk to each candidate for an hour, Rick Warren at the Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, which took place over the weekend. For those, you know, the Olympics were going on, Michael Phelps was swimming, so I don't know how many people kept track of all of that, but I'm sure that some of you did. And, well, a number of different issues. As we get close to the Democratic Convention, which starts a week from today. Wow. So join us, and you're always welcome to at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, call the Milwaukee line at 414-227-2050, 227-2050, or send an email if you'd like, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Charles Lipson, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Let's start with the resignation of Musharraf. A surprise to you or not?
It had been rumored for several weeks, and I think that the key issue, which we don't really know about now, is the terms that he got for resigning. That is, what is the regime in Pakistan promised him in terms of future prosecutions and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And who's next?
Yeah, why don't you fill out that question a little bit, Kathleen?
Who's going to follow him?
In Pakistan?
Uh-huh.
Well, I think that the big issue in Pakistan, is, from the United States perspective, there are two big issues. One is it really a country anymore? That is to say, is it one of these countries that's in the process? It is in the process of decomposing in lots of ways. And so I think one of our concerns, and it's a concern that's shared by a lot of countries around the world, is there really a capable government in the region, not just in areas like Waziristan, where we know that the writ of the Pakistani government doesn't run, but across the whole country. And the second thing is that their security service, the ISI, was quite deliberately by Musharraf's predecessor made into a kind of Islamicist organization in lots of ways. They set up the Taliban in neighboring Afghanistan to sort of make sure their back was protected as Pakistan faced toward India. So one of the issues has been, are parts of the Pakistani government, in particular their security services, giving protection to the very terrorists that the United States is trying to go after, many of which have gone over the border into Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. It has been described as one of the most dangerous countries in the world. Will the next president face extraordinary challenges with Pakistan, do you think?
You bet. You bet. And there are really a couple of challenges. One is that they have nuclear weapons, and we know that the AQ Khan network was spreading them everywhere. Now, they have not let Khan be interviewed by any outsiders. They, quote, kept him under house arrest, but he's a national hero. And it was he who spread nuclear technology, which we think was actually technology, which we know was technology stolen from the West, and they did it in cooperation with the North Koreans. They spread it to Iran and some other countries. And so there's all this there are a series of nuclear issues. Will they spread the technology? Do they have control over the weapons that they do have? Who in the government has control? I mean, there's no question in the United States that the civilian senior leadership of the United States has control of the weapons. And even so, in a very tightly run ship, and the U.S. and has clearly the tightest controls, we've seen problems where parts of weapons sort of end up in the wrong place, dropping out of airplanes, going across the country. So that's one issue. I mean, do they have control over them? Who has control over them? Are they shipping the technology out? That's a whole series of complicated questions for whoever's the president. And then the second thing has to do with their sponsorship of terror organizations or providing safe havens to these groups, because it appears that the mountains that are next to Afghanistan are becoming a kind of international training ground and safe haven for al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've had a chance to read Ron Susskind's book yet, but it certainly makes you pretty worried about all of those nuclear weapons, whose hands they're in, how easy it is to get them, and how people need to pay attention to the issue.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very scary issue, and over the long term, the knowledge of nuclear weapons just becomes broader and broader. I think, in general, states are very careful and cautious about spreading this. It's not something that a terrorist organization would be likely to be able to build on its own, or even if it had the knowledge of how to do it. So the question is, will there be any handoff? The more dangerous issue for weapons of mass destruction, I think, has to do with biological agents.
Mm-hmm. How did Musharraf go from being the talk show circuit darling in the United States not that long ago to resigning as prime minister? What happened to him in the meantime? He was a big star in this country.
Well, being a big star in the United States doesn't even necessarily ensure you'll be elected president of the United States.
Yeah, I see your point.
And he did have, I mean, I can recall watching him on the Jon Stewart show.
Exactly. I did too.
I think that the audience for the Jon Stewart show is fairly small in Pakistan, is my understanding.
I think you're probably right. Georgia, also on the table here. Let's talk of it in
Georgia's on your mind?
Georgia's on our minds today. And let's talk about it in terms of who gets a political advantage from this, who understands this issue better, who McCain is sending to Georgia, who Obama is sending to Georgia. And here's another issue that we didn't think would be on the table for the next president in a huge way, and perhaps it will be, the relationship with Russia. Does it benefit McCain? Is he seen as somebody who's stronger on these kinds of international issues?
It benefits McCain immensely, and it benefits him in a couple of ways. First, in general, over the last 40 or 50 years, Republicans sort of poll higher and do better when foreign policy issues are prominent, even though the experience of the Bush administration might lead you to question that. It is nevertheless the case that, as far as Obama is concerned, the more this election is about two things, change and the economy, economic performance, the more it's in Obama's court. The more it's about foreign policy and we need an experienced hand at the helm, the more it's in McCain's court.
Mm-hmm. What about – I'm sorry.
And I think that McCain has – McCain came out of the box on this pretty strong without sounding really belligerent. That is, he sounded confident and strong. And in fact, better than the Bush administration. The Bush administration, I'm shocked to find that they fumbled the ball. Hmm. Let me just say two or three things about how they fumbled it before we go back to the the politics of it. The first thing is Russia, for a century and a half, two centuries, has expanded out of the area of central Russia to its south and, to some extent, to its northwest, that is into the Baltic area, but it's expanded into the Caucasus. When the Soviet Revolution took place in 1917, it kind of folded back a little bit, and then it expanded again back into those traditional areas. When the Soviet Union imploded between 1989 and 1991, ultimately they lost control of areas that had been incorporated into the Soviet Union. Those included Ukraine, Georgia, all the stands that are in the Caucasus and so forth. And what you see now is, in a way, a traditional Russian policy of reasserting its strength and domination in the area. They actually call it sometimes the Monrovsky Doctrine, like in an analogy to our Monroe Doctrine, where we don't want to see the Soviet Union in the 1960s. We didn't want to see them in Cuba. So they have had this as a long-term policy, and they've been very clear about it. And in a meeting about 4 months ago with Bush, Putin made clear that NATO membership for Georgia and Ukraine, both of which are on the line, joining NATO, the words that are quoted in the news reports are crossed a red line for the Russians. So on the one hand, we did that. We haven't admitted them, but we're continuing to talk. And that's on the one hand. NATO is expanding, and this started under Clinton. Clinton has expanded NATO. It's gone into Poland and all of these areas to the east that were traditional Russian areas of domination. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, we've acted as if this would not threaten the Russians, and we've done nothing to protect these countries. So on the one hand, we're provoking. We're throwing up a red flag and kind of taunting them. And on the other hand, we're doing nothing really to protect these countries against the threat that the Russians actually pose.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll do that in just one moment. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Professor Charles Lipson, teaches international politics at the University of Chicago. He's a professor of political science with specialty in international politics and international relations. Also the author of two recently released books, Doing Honest Work in College and Succeeding as an International Student in the United States and Canada. Our number, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have the second hour of our program today. We'll talk about 2 Million Minutes, which is a documentary that has recently been released, and it looks at the number of minutes that students have from the time they graduate from eighth grade until they graduate from college. It's 2 million minutes to prepare for college and ultimately for a career. And the film traces six students, two from the United States, from Indiana, two from China, and two from India. And you'll be amazed by what you hear about how rigorous the academic program is in China and India when you compare it with the United States. So that's coming up. Our number two, Professor Charles Lipson, is here now, and let's go to phone calls for him, starting with Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to focus on the situation with Georgia and cite some interesting articles that I've run across. From the Saturday Chicago Sun-Times, Robert Shear, who also has this article under truthdig.com, he talks about what a stark contradiction that the United States, which championed Kosovo's independence from Serbia, is now ignoring Georgia's invasion of its own ethnically rebellious provinces. And he also mentions that an advisor, the article in the Saturday Sun-Times, said, is Russia-Georgia war an election ploy designed by the neocons, and mentions that McCain's senior foreign policy advisor worked 4 years as a paid lobbyist for the Georgian government. Also, there in today's Chicago, sometimes there's an article, groundwork for Georgia mess was laid in Kosovo, and also in the QT section by Zay Smith in the Sun-Times, Bush is quoted as saying bullying and intimidation are not acceptable ways to conduct foreign policy in the 21st century. And John McCain, in the 21st century, nations don't invade other nations. So apparently all of the standards apply to Russia, but not for ourselves vis-a-vis Iraq. And, it just strikes me how bogus all of their posturing is on this.
Charles.
Those are interesting points. Let me try to respond. I think the key point about Kosovo that you're making, Jim, is you're making really a couple of points. One is that Russia was very irritated by U.S. policy in the Balkans. And in particular, I mean, this is an area where World War I started because there is a Slavic population there. And the Russians view themselves in a kind of pan-Slavic way as the protector of those groups. So they haven't liked to see, and in the case of Kosovo, the United States supported not the sort of Central Serbian government, but the group that was a kind of minority group in Kosovo to break away there. So that provoked the Russians for sure, and they made that very clear at the time. But I think that there is an important distinction. I think that the implicit idea that somehow, hey, all big powers do this, that's true to some extent. Big powers behave in a kind of swaggering fashion, and the United States has certainly done that, and the Russians certainly do that. But there is a substantial difference between a non-democratic government that's run by ex-KGB guys who seem to slam their fist down all the time, invading a country, Georgia, that has a democratically elected government, and the policies that the United States pursued against Saddam Hussein. I think that you can criticize, and Lord knows people have, U.S. policy in Iraq, but I think drawing an exact parallel between the two really stretches the point.
Mm-hmm. Does it, though, lessen, considering our action in Iraq and Senator McCain's criticism of the way the war was conducted, but not the war itself. It's such a huge event for the United States and has so defined the past few years and elections the past few years. Does it lessen the impact of what he has to say because he has been identified more with the war against Iraq was justified?
Yeah, well, I think that McCain has pluses and minuses from his connection with Iraq. One thing we know about wars, there's all this stuff about wag the dog. You start a war because it gives you political support. That turns out over the long term in virtually all wars to be short term in the United States. Even during World War II, the good war, which we were winning, certainly from 43 onward, it was very clear to the American public we were winning. Franklin Roosevelt's popularity was dropping over time. He won the elections in 44 by less than he'd won the others. So people get tired of the war even if you're winning. But when you pursue it as incompetently for the first several years as the Bush administration did, support is going to drop very rapidly. McCain, however, has the advantage that the policies that actually succeeded were the ones that he was pushing for all along. He did not sort of give strong support to Rumsfeld and to all those people who and to the generals who were fighting the war using the wrong strategy. Mm-hmm. He was the guy behind the surge at a time when people people like Harry Reid were saying this war is lost. And so I think that McCain is – if McCain was running on Bush's record on the war, he would be much more vulnerable than he is running on his own record.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Let's go next to Ray from Merrimack. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I'm Kathleen. Sir, something that's been upsetting me is this. First, John McCain sending emissaries to Georgia, and now I hear Obama is doing the same thing. And I understand that John McCain actually gave advice to the president of Georgia. I thought we had one president and one secretary of state, not as many as want to open their mouth. Isn't that rather dangerous?
That's an excellent point, Ray. And in fact, there are constitutional provisions that there's only one person to do that. But that's been over the last – in an open world where everybody can get on an airplane. Jimmy Carter seems to run his own foreign policy, right? But I think that, this is a real problem. Let me say what the government has done to try to deal with some of this. Once the nominees have been selected or presumptively selected, because neither has actually been confirmed by its convention, but they're presumably the nominees, they're eligible to receive and do receive briefings that are classified from the U.S. government. And this is so that they won't inadvertently reveal things that they shouldn't know, or they'll be talking from whatever base of knowledge the U.S. government has. Now, we know from the fact that the weapons of mass destruction were a slam dunk, as the head of the CIA called them, Tenet at the time, that the U.S. government's information can be wrong too. But the fact is we don't try to rein in what they say. And you're right, that can cause problems. But everybody in the world – but we do try to give these candidates as much information as can be given to them so that they won't be talking off the top of their heads. But you're right. It can send mixed messages.
Sure.
On the other hand, the whole world knows that Bush only has a few more months left. So everybody is looking for signals. If you were sitting out there in Palestine or Israel or Georgia or Ukraine or China or Taiwan or North Korea or Pakistan, you would be thinking, well, I am pretty sure it's either going to be McCain or it's going to be Obama, and I'm looking to see whether I should do something right now with the Bush administration or whether I should hold off and all the rest. And there's nothing you can do about that.
Anything else, Ray?
No, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much.
I appreciate
much.
It, Ray.
Oh, thank you. And what do you think about the choices? McCain is sending Lieberman, and who else is he sending to Georgia?
I don't know the full crew of people.
Right.
I think that all of that is designed to say two or three things to the American public and very little to Georgia other than we care. It's designed to say we think this is important enough that we're going to send people who are close to us out to this area.
Mm-hmm.
It's more important in a way for Obama, who has less policy experience. So whether or not he makes Biden his vice presidential choice, and this would certainly be some additional incentive to do so, whether or not he does that, he can say, look, I'm very close to Biden. He will be one of my senior foreign policy aides. And he's been there. He's a steady hand and so forth. The problem with Biden is that he's not exactly a steady hand. He's very knowledgeable about foreign policy, but he's constantly putting his foot in his mouth, including about Obama early on. Remember, he sort of said he's clean and he's well-spoken.
Right.
Well, yes, that's not exactly high praise, and it seemed to be a backhanded compliment about his being an African-American. So Biden is not exactly the soul of discretion when it comes to speaking.
He does like to speak, too, doesn't he? He likes to talk.
Well, for two of us who are spending our hour on the phone, I don't know that we should be casting any bricks through that glass wall, Kathleen.
No, I like to hear him speak. I enjoy him. Thanks, Ray.
Yeah, but no, he is not. He's not a Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah. Let's go to Daniel from Rice Lake. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. According to Russian doctrine, if the U.S. attacks Russian forces with precision-guided munitions, Russia will retaliate with tactical nuclear weapons. Two SS-21 ballistic missile launchers are in South Ossetia, capable of delivering a small conventional warhead or tactical nuclear weapons. Why would Russia move two SS-21 missile launchers into South Ossetia?
That is an excellent question, Daniel, and I'm glad you introduced that point. What we see with Russia moving into that area is it seems to be saying we're in absolute control of South Ossetia. If we give it back to Georgia at all, and that's not at all clear that they will do so, then we'll only do so under the conditions of it, in effect, being neutralized. In the Cold War, it used to be called Finlandized, because Finland was not formally a part of the Soviet Empire, but it was, in effect, all of its foreign policies were controlled by Moscow. It never did anything that contravened them. And they have moved missiles in there, and those missiles can reach the capital of Georgia, Tbilisi. Now, and the second element of that is that countries are constantly sending each other messages. There's a very famous old joke among diplomacists, and I think it actually happened. There was a very famous conference at the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1814-15 over that winter, and a Russian ambassador was coming to the conference with certain messages, and on the way there, he died, and several of the diplomats from other countries were talking about his death en route, and one of them said, "I wonder what he meant by that." So we actually try to read meaning into all these things, mm-hmm. and that's one of the reasons that the Russians have sent it there. Yes, they could send nuclear weapons. I think that the likelihood that they would use nuclear weapons is vanishingly small unless they end up in a direct conflict with U.S. troops. So I think it's quite unlikely that the U.S. will send troops that would be put in a position where they could conflict with Russian troops. Secondly, the Russians have enough conventional forces in the area to take whatever they need. They won't need to use nuclear weapons. So I would not be as worried about the nuclear weapons, but I would be worried about the future of South Ossetia as an independent region, I would be worried about the future of Georgia and all the countries that surround Russia that were part of the old Russian Empire or part of the Soviet Empire or satellite states are now extremely worried. And I don't think that NATO can go on like it did before. It can't simply say, hey, we promise if you're a member of our club, then nobody will make any trouble for you. We can't jump half the Grand Canyon. If we're going to jump the Grand Canyon, we've got to jump it. If we're not, we don't. And what that means is if we're going to let countries into NATO, we have to be not only prepared for their military defense, we have to send that clear signal in advance. We have to put resources in order to do that, or else we shouldn't do it at all. And that's a very fundamental decision, and that debate has not been joined in Europe, really, or in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I expect that will happen after the heat of this moment dies down.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Daniel, for the call. An email from Karen from Platteville, who wants you to comment on Chuck Hagel, Wesley Clark, and Jim Webb all have military experience. Hagel, she says, would draw some Republican votes to the ticket. He has intimate knowledge of how voting machines can change vote totals for a candidate. The other two have military experience, with Webb, of course, being a U.S. senator from Virginia now.
I personally think that Hegel is kind of a non-starter. I mean, these are just my personal views. I think Clark is absolutely a non-starter. He's put his foot in his mouth. He's directly and in a personal way challenged McCain as being essentially unfit for command because of his prior experience. He didn't lead anything and so forth. Clark's never been elected to anything, and it shows when he runs. He seems to win very few votes. So he has some military experience, but it's not as if he's but I think that of these people, Webb and Biden would probably bring the most to the ticket. But I think that the question from Platteville is exactly right in saying that all those weeks on the – all those days on the beach in Hawaii are over now. You've got to think very seriously about the trade-offs involved in being – in picking a vice president. And the basic trade-off is you've got two or three key states that are possibly in play. Indiana might be one, so you might do well to pick an Evan Bayh or something like that in order to pick up that kind of a state. And he's a relatively bland and moderately popular figure outside of his own state, and he's very popular in his own state.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way to go. And the other way is to beef up your foreign policy side. And I think what this tells you is that foreign policy, the weight attached to foreign policy issues will be heavier now than it was 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And that increases the likelihood of a guy like Webb or Biden rather than somebody like Governor Sebelius or Evan Bayh or somebody who's more a domestic figure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about for McCain?
I think McCain has to solve two problems. Let me go with that and then get to names. I think that the first problem is because McCain is older and has had cancer, people are going to be especially concerned that whoever is his candidate for vice president be prepared on day one to take over as the president of the United States should that be necessary, because it's just got to be in the back of people's minds that there could be a necessity. By the way, picking a very young candidate then would be ruled out, it seems to me, on those grounds and also on the grounds that it makes McCain look older.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one issue. And I think that McCain also has relatively little experience on the economy. We always say we like our candidates to be truthful and candid. McCain says, hey, I've been a security person. I haven't done as much about the economy.
Right.
He said this months ago. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, he gets kicked in the crotch, you know, repeatedly for having said that. So on the one hand, we want people to say something truthful. And on the other hand, you're subject to attack when you do. I think he was being candid. He's not as experienced on the economy. And so I think even though he's not a particular fan of Mitt Romney, that gives somebody who has a kind of economic background, has already been vetted, gives him a little more weight. I don't know that he'll go that way. He's been vetting people like – I mean, obviously – Lieberman is one person he clearly feels comfortable with. There's been talk about Representative Cantor from Virginia, who is a younger guy. Although he's a leader in the House, he's and is known and liked by conservatives. He doesn't have that kind of foreign policy experience. So I don't, you know, I mean, it's hard to say. I don't get terribly much into the guessing game, except I try to think a little bit about the general calculations the candidates need to make.
More phone calls in just one moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 18th of August, and Professor Charles Lipson is our guest. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago and is particularly interested and teaches international politics and international relations. Also writes for students about academic success and honest work at the university level. He is the author of two fairly recent books, Doing Honest Work in College and Succeeding as an International Student in the U.S. and Canada. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee, or send an email, as Karen did, and that's talk@WPR.org. Some of you may have, and if you did, please call in. This was an Irish Fest weekend, and what can I say? There was also the Olympics, and I'm a swimmer. I was watching Phelps. So I followed some of the news about the interviews of McCain and Obama by Rick Warren at the Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, which I thought was an interesting thing for both of these candidates to appear at. But some of you, I'm sure, paid much more attention to that. So what did you think of that whole event? More phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, we will be speaking with a Harvard Business School graduate who's a venture capitalist and entrepreneur with 25 years of experience. And he says that he has had to consistently hire workers from India and China for his high-tech companies, not because he wants to pay lower wages, but because they have higher brain power. He can't find the talent in the United States. This prompted a very interesting documentary titled 2 Million Minutes, a number of minutes that you have from the time you graduate from eighth grade until the time you graduate from high school. And he looks at students in the United States, two students in the U.S., two students in India, and two students in China. The results in the film, and we'll be with him to talk about all of that the second hour of our show. All right, back to phone calls for Charles Lipson, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And we go to Gary from Fitchburg next. Hello, Gary.
Hi. I'm a keen observer of geopolitics as well as politics in the U.S. It appears to me, you know, that Russia has a very sharp person at the head of its country in Putin, and the people running Russia have gone around the world to secure natural resources. Their attack, or actually after Georgia made its move, Russia's then counterattack to secure Georgia, it looks like for the Caspian Sea pipeline through there, it gives Russia, again, much more power, much more dominance. While the United States has been run and is run by people, in my opinion, who are not patriots, they look at the United States as just another egg to suck dry. And here we go again. George Bush and the neocons are pursuing policies that ramp up tensions around the world to justify more military spending, more of our tax dollars going down the drain to the military-industrial complex. And I also think this plays right into the hands of the master planners, because we now have a very weak Democratic presidential candidate in Obama, and I think McCain is going to end up being president, and that, again, shovels more money to the military-industrial complex.
Who are these master planners?
Who are the master planners? Well, if you don't know by now, my friend, you need to do some homework. The master planners are if you look, the master planners are companies like Halliburton, Bechtel. Those kinds of people have been in control of our foreign policy for a long time. That's why we see policies that on their face do not serve the country well, but serve the coffers of these corporations that manufacture all this hardware that gets blown off, blown up, and sent around the world.
Charles.
I disagree with the way that Gary frames the issue in several ways. First of all, I don't see the U.S. Policies as being conspiratorial and directed by these murky master planners. I see it I see often misguided policies and sometimes rightly guided policies. I certainly see that we spend half the money in the world on the military, and that benefits in an immense way companies that are engaged in that. And I could go on about that. I want to say something about Putin. I think in one sense Putin is sharp. But I think in another sense, he's not. You know that old joke that you hear about, to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think Putin is a man with a hammer. He's a kind of KGB military security espionage guy. And whenever he deals with economic issues, he deals with them in that way. And so we saw in disputes with Ukraine last year, cutting off oil and gas to them for a few days. And we see, again, efforts to control pipelines. In the short term, that gives you a certain kind of dominance. But in the long term, it doesn't. And I want to say two problems that the Russians are really facing now that I think people are not being sufficiently attentive to. One is that the more that they exercise political control over hydrocarbon supplies, the more the Europeans and other consumers are worried and look to other resources, not only green resources, but other sources of supply. This was a big issue during the Cold War. The Soviet Union actually wanted to build pipelines to Europe, and Germany in particular wanted those pipelines. A number of Europeans wanted those pipelines. The U.S. attitude was basically, even if Bechtel or Halliburton or anybody else was going to build them, we didn't want those pipelines. And the reason we didn't want them was we thought it gave would give the Soviet Union control over the oil spigot to the European economies, and so we didn't want that. This was a case where geopolitics dominated economic concerns. The second thing that I think Putin has wrong is if you look at China, what you see is a country that's really going forward in terms of its economic development. I'm not saying that that little oak tree will go all the way to the sky, but the areas that are along the coast in China and the industrial areas have been growing at 10% a year for almost 25 to 30 years. The Chinese economy has increased eightfold or more in 25 years in terms of its GDP per capita. The Russian economy, it seems to me, is an oil bubble economy. It really looks more, in a certain sense, like Saudi Arabia than like a Western economy. The fact that oil prices have been high gives it a certain kind of economic wealth, but it has not produced an economy that is capable on a broad range of industrial products and, most importantly, the knowledge industries of the 21st century, exactly what you're going to be talking about, Kathleen, mm-hmm. in the next hour. Mm-hmm. It has not been doing anything to produce those, where the Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, they've all been doing it. The Russians have been doing what the Saudis and some and the Kuwaitis and the other oil-rich countries do, sucking stuff out of the ground and considering that wealth. Well, what we know about how countries get wealthy over long periods of time is they get wealthy with brain power, not with resources.
And thank you very much for your call. Let's go next to Marion from Madison. Hello, Marion.
Hello. I have a question. I want to know why everybody seems to be writing off Richardson from New Mexico as a vice presidential candidate, because I see him pulling in the Hispanic population, having influence over not only New Mexico but Colorado and other western states. The Hispanic population is the largest growing minority population in our country right now. Actually, it's the largest growing population, period, in our country right now.
It's an excellent point, Marion. It's an excellent point you're making, Marion. Richardson brings some foreign policy experience, and he brings the vetting that comes with having run for a president. He served at a high level administratively, and he has a tremendous attractiveness both to Hispanic voters and to people in the Southwest. And the fact that he has administrative experience is important because 5 or 6 years ago, Barack Obama was the state senator for my little area of Chicago. And so he's moved from being a state senator to being a national senator, but he hasn't been a governor. He hasn't run a big administrative bureaucracy and so forth. Richardson has. Having said all that, I think Richardson also brings a number of deficits, which is the reason that you're not seeing him in absolutely first place. And one was that when he ran the Energy Department, there were a lot of problems there, including that whole problem with the Chinese espionage, and was it really espionage? And then they put this guy Wen Ho Lee in, on trial, and it was just a big mess. And his stewardship at the Energy Department didn't really add a lot of luster to him. Another thing is that you hear kind of Bill Clinton-esque rumors about Richardson. I don't know whether they're true, and I don't mean to spread them, but I've certainly talked to a number of political insiders who say that that's an issue that would have to be considered. I don't know whether – I assume that if the issues – I mean, we all know – how, you know, that was the end of John Edwards, right, as a political figure. I'm not saying anything like that about Bill Richardson. I'm just saying that there are people out there who have been circulating rumors, and I think that those rumors either have to be dispelled in Obama's mind or he'll pick something conservative, because those of us who've got a little gray hair on our heads remember Tom Eagleton. Tom Eagleton was a senator from Missouri. He was picked as a vice presidential candidate, and then a few days later, he was found to have had electroshock treatment and had to withdraw. And that withdrawal was just deadly to that campaign. So my hunch is that the two key people, Eric Holder Jack Kennedy's daughter, who are really vetting the candidates, will have gone through all this material very carefully. If it's not an issue, if it's merely rumors, Richardson would be right at the top of the heap. If not, I think he wouldn't be. Let me say one more thing about Richardson's foreign policy experience. There are two kinds of foreign policy experience that people have. One is that they do things like we've seen Jesse Jackson do very effectively a number of times, which is go into very delicate areas and do some tactical negotiations, often getting a hostage out. That's very important work, but that's different from deciding big strategic issues like should NATO expand? What should our policy toward China be? Richardson has more of the tactical experience. He goes in and does negotiations in delicate situations, and that's very important work. But he's not been a person who's been known for the kind of thinking about large foreign policy issues that, say, Joe Biden has been. So I think he has strengths, but he has weaknesses, and he has question marks, and all of those would need to be resolved.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Dan from White Lake. Hi.
Good morning. I'm wondering if I'm the only one that heard the Georgians started this shindig, perhaps at the instance of the United States, because they were laboring under the misconception that NATO would back them up. They're the first ones that started lobbing shells into South whatchamacallit there.
Ossetia, South Ossetia.
And the other thing I was going to say is, on my map, the road from Moscow to Tehran and the road from Moscow to Baghdad, one right through Georgia, and is no longer than the road from Chicago to Los Angeles. And I'll listen to what you have to say.
These are excellent points, and I'm delighted that you make them. The caucuses are a strategic reason. The second point that you make is absolutely a critical point that everybody should understand. Georgia is part of the caucuses. The caucuses are a critical region. They've been part of the Russian Empire, even though they're not ethnically a part of Russia for a long time. The Russians really consider them their backyard. And the second reason that they're strategically important is that they are the oil and gas pipeline. Some of the caucuses, not Georgia, have oil and gas. Pipelines run across to the Black Sea because then you can move the stuff out over water. And the third point about their strategic significance is that they stand between Russia and the Persian Gulf and the Middle East in general. And so it's a strategically important region. Now, your first – and that's why –
We have to end on that because we're out of time.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Charles, for being with us. Charles Lipson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, teaches international politics and international relations, and is the author of a couple just released books. One is Doing Honest Work in College, and the other Succeeding as an International Student in the U.S. and Canada. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks, everybody, for your calls. News ahead will return on the Ideas Network.